Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. In the mood to seek out some exotic locales? On this week's show, we're embarking on a trip of exploration from China to Tel Aviv to Prague and beyond. Our tour guides are some of the best in the world of international food and drink. Audra Ang gives us a tour of the Museum of Chinese in America, where we learn the double entendre of the words sour, sweet, bitter, spicy. Then we stop in Israel for a cocktail they call a French 57, which is also the name of Oran Lerner's New Orleans-style bar there. Finally, Andrew Lawler joins us to solve the eternal mystery. How did the chicken cross the world? It's the trip of a lifetime on this week's Louisiana Eats.
My name is Audra Ang, and I'm the author of To the People, Food is Heaven, and I'm also a co-curator of Sour, Sweet, Bitter, Spicy Stories of Chinese Food and Identity in America at the Museum of Chinese in America.
As a journalist for the Associated Press, Audra Ang has traveled the world in search of a story to tell. As co-curator of Sour, Sweet, Bitter, Spicy, an exhibit at New York's Museum of Chinese in America, she shares the tales of Chinese immigrants' lives in America and how food has eased their transition from immigrant to American. Audra, to the Chinese, those words, sour, sweet, bitter, spicy, actually has two meanings, doesn't it?
It does. Sour, sweet, bitter, spicy is actually a Chinese saying, and it's suan tian ku la, which means, it kind of means obviously the four tastes that you can have, sour, sweet, bitter, spicy. So it kind of references the balance of flavors in Chinese cooking that's really important. But it also represents the ups and downs of life, the sour, sweet, bitter, spicy chapters that you'd have in a life.
It's such a beautiful, beautiful expression. This exhibit, we're going to all have to take a trip there virtually since we're not in New York, we're in New Orleans. But when I researched the exhibit and what you all were doing, one of the things that really struck me was that not only did I find very familiar names like Cecilia Chang, Ming Tsai, Martin Yan, you also included restaurateurs and even home cooks. So explain to me why you all went into all three facets of that to explain sour, sweet, bitter, spicy.
There are, first of all, four curators for the show, and it was kind of cool because it kind of represented the superpowers, the four areas of skill that we have. You know, we have the two of the museum's curators, and then we have a cookbook author, and then we have me, and we kind of represented different facets of how we could put the exhibition together. It took us a while to kind of figure out who the 33 people were going to be in the show. We wanted, obviously, a range, an age range. We wanted to include both men and women. We wanted to make sure we covered the scope of America, not just the coast, but, you know, the South or in the Midwest. We also wanted to make sure we covered the different cuisines throughout China. And that's pretty impossible because, you know, they're not just eight great cuisines, but there's a whole span of everything in between. One of the things we wanted to do was, as you said, give a nod to, you know, the grandfather of Chinese cuisine, Ken Ham, and the grandmother of Chinese cuisine, Cecilia Chang, and people that everyone know, well-known people like Ming Tsai and Martin Yan. We also wanted to give a nod to rising stars like Jason Wong and Chris Chung and other people, Wilson Tang, who are big names in New York, the New York food scene, and Danny Bowen from Mission Chinese. But my part of it that I wanted to make sure we really included that was really close to my heart are the people in the middle who are just regular home cooks, people who came from China, who of Chinese descent, who grew up here, so that we gave a good representation of the different challenges and the different sweet memories and the different, you know, bitter experiences people had while coming, while being in America and being Chinese in America.
Speaking of the home cooks who were involved, Ni Biying, the 80-year-old grandmother, her story really blew me away. Tell us about her.
So she's actually the relative of someone who works at the museum. And again, we were kind of drawing from personal experiences while we put together the show. And so she had brought some food to let people in the museum just, you know, just a simple meal. And everyone was kind of like blown away. She's from Fujian, the Fujian province in southern China. And so as part of the whole thing about including home cooks, we really wanted to include her. Her interview was all in Mandarin. And as you know, she was just talking about what it was like growing, you know, being in New York many years ago where things were a lot cheaper, or talking about crabs.
Well, apparently even at the age of 80, she has a small dinner party, and that means 12 different dishes. How does an 80-year-old grandmother accomplish that? And why is that necessary for a Chinese woman to do that?
I think that's one of the things that I love about Chinese culture. You welcome people with food. That's how you show people that they're beloved and treasured, and that's how you're a good host. I mean, I guess it's not necessarily just Chinese culture where you do that, but, you know, you kind of break out the best for your guests. And I think that's why she felt it necessary not to just cook, you know, a couple of her signature dishes, but to have a feast of 12 dishes.
Well, you have described the kitchen itself as a sphere of comfort when someone comes to a new country and you don't understand what's going on around you and you don't even have your familiar ingredients. So how have you seen these various Chinese immigrants make the kitchen, their sphere of comfort?
I think that was one of the common threads that ran through a lot of our interviews. And I think that is something that a lot of people can identify with. You know, if you're new to a country, what do you do? I mean, one of the first things you probably do is to cook things from home to remind you of home and to kind of make yourself feel a little less alien. Setting up a kitchen, I mean, I know one of the home cooks I interviewed, he had a noodle maker that he brought from China. It literally is something that you kind of rub your dough against and it'll kind of cut out bits of noodles. And that's something that he really prized. One of the things we asked people to do for the exhibition, all the cooks, they shared something that was precious to them from their kitchen. So we actually have one of Martin Yen's woks, for example, that's hanging on the wall at the exhibition. And this home cook shared his noodle maker. And so I think bringing tools from home or having those kind of tools that can make your food is something really important to have on hand when you're at someplace new. And the whole ingredients thing, too. A lot of them talked about coming to America and not having the Asian grocery stores. One of the chefs talked about how there was no black vinegar, for example. So they mixed white vinegar with soy sauce or something that kind of approximated what was the taste of black vinegar. So it's, yeah, just kind of like pulling pieces together to make home feel like home, your new home feel like home.
Audra, take us on a tour, a virtual tour of the exhibit.
So the exhibit consists of two rooms. The main room has a giant dining table in the center of it that has the bios of each of our 33 chefs and home cooks that we featured, but also sculptures done by two really talented sculptors, ceramic sculptors. And there are 16 of them, I think, in the center of the table that represent the regional cuisines that we represented. And then there are 33 smaller ones representing the chefs. And they're really beautiful. So there's this whole dinner table in the center, and then there are three walls. One of them would features kind of the explanation of the exhibit and, you know, what it's about and how we kind of curated it. And then another wall it's a video of all these interviews condensed into an hour and a half long story, basically an hour and a half long conversation between these chefs. And so that's divided into four chapters: sour, sweet, bitter, spicy. Sour would be some of the troubles or maybe, you know, discrimination that they faced when they first got here.
Do you have any of those stories to share?
I think a lot of it was, you know, for older people like Ken Hom, I think how people viewed Chinese was a lot less favorable back then. And so he kind of had to fight stereotypes, you know, like I have a voice and I know what I'm doing. And I think he mentioned in one anecdote that people would say to him, you speak English really well. And he like grew up in Arizona and he's like, yeah, I grew up speaking the language and probably I speak it better than you do. So it's like little things like that that people had to deal with. And then sweet are, you know, the beautiful childhood memories of meals or just, you know, remembering being at your grandmother's table or what it was like eating with your family. Spicy would be kind of like fun firecracker anecdotes, you know, about that they've had in life. And bitter would be basically the long hours people had to put in when they worked in kitchens, you know, just like bitterness of hard work making it in this country. And so that's one wall. And then the first wall explains the exhibit. And then the third wall is basically projecting images that the chefs have shared of, you know, them as children or them cooking. And then most painfully, the dishes that they cook, which look ridiculously delicious. And I was like, why don't we have food at the exhibit? Because we're just torturing people with all this hashtag food porn. But so that's what it's like. And the reception for this has just been incredible. It's actually been so good that it was supposed to close in March, but we've extended it till the end of September. I think it's been eye-opening for people who have gone because a lot of people don't know that there are that many regional cuisines, or a lot of people want to, you know, love the intimate look into the lives of people that they hear about, like Martinina, and people who are really well-known, but also just like to learn about what it's like to be a regular immigrant, a home cook, someone who cooks every day in anonymity because it's what they do, it's what they do for their family, and it's part of life. So I think it's just a great range. It's just a great way to learn about not only Chinese food, but what it's like to be Chinese in America.
Did curating this exhibit change your life in any way?
Curating this exhibit kind of reminded me how much I love telling stories. And I love telling stories of people, but I also love talking about food. So this pretty much combined the best of both worlds. And it's also obviously telling stories about people of Chinese descent, because I can relate to that. And a lot of it was kind of like saying, oh yeah, that's how I feel, or that's what my grandmother used to say, or, you know, I totally understand how you feel about this because I feel that same way, or my parents did this. And so it changed my life in that, yeah, it really reminded me how much I love telling stories of people and how much I love eating. And also just eating all the food was a great way to bond because, you know, to the people, food is heaven.
Audra Ong, co-curator of Sour, Sweet, Bitter, Spicy at the Museum of Chinese in America. When we come back from a short break, we'll talk with author Andrew Lawler about how the lowly chicken transformed society. Stay tuned. Look for comfort now within these
walls. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Ralph Brennan's Redfish Grill. From Dock to Pot, offering 9 varieties of fresh Gulf fish daily. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 115 Bourbon Street in the French Quarter. Journalist Andrew Lawler is a contributing writer for Science Magazine, whose stories focus on the topics of space, science, and technology. With his book, Why Did the Chicken Cross the World?, Andrew uses his analytical eye to give us a comprehensive history of the chicken, an animal that's played a quintessential role in the development of human civilization.
Well, let's step back for a second. You know, most people would know that the domesticated dog came from the wolf, right? But how many people know where the chicken came from? And this is the question I set out to answer. It's not really clear exactly what happened, but what I discovered was that a lot of researchers think that chickens were domesticated not for their meat and not for their eggs. They were domesticated for religious ritual and for cockfighting.
Wow.
And the chicken comes from the red jungle fowl. It's a wild bird that lives in South Asia in bamboo thickets.
So the red jungle fowl, tell me a little bit about that creature.
Well, first, the red jungle fowl and the chicken are so close that they're the same species. So in the past 50, 60 years, as populations have increased in South Asia, the native habitat of the red jungle fowl, the result has been that the chickens have been breeding with the red jungle fowl. So the red jungle fowl are no longer quite as wild as they used to be. So there really are probably no pure red jungle fowl left. There's no pure wild chicken left in South Asia. But 60 years ago, there was a push to get better game birds for southern hunters.
Yeah, we just can't get enough pheasant, quail, ducks. How does the chicken figure in?
Well, there wasn't much in the way. Beyond quail, there really weren't many pheasants that lived in the South. So the U.S. government sent Gardner Bump, who was a biologist from New York State, sent him overseas with his wife. And for 20 years, they searched for the perfect game fowl that could be brought to the United States and released, particularly in the South, so that hunters would have more than quail to shoot. So where did he go? He went to the place where you find red jungle fowl. He went to the foothills of the Himalayas, and he spent a good deal of time collecting as many as he could. This is back in the early 1960s. Those were shipped back to the U.S., distributed to game facilities, including several here in Louisiana, and then they were released. Now, almost everywhere they died off. Oh. Possums don't exist in India, and they probably saw a good meal and knew it.
Coyotes.
Right. You name it. You name it. Or disease. We don't really know. But in one place in Georgia, they did survive. And now there is a very small group that remains purebred that exist in, you know, three or four different flocks. And those birds are very important because they may actually have the DNA, the only DNA left of the pure wild chicken.
Well, thank goodness for Gardner Bump and those southern hunters, huh?
Absolutely.
Let's go further back in time. The 1840s, the early 1840s, were really a seminal turning point in many ways for the chicken and Europeans and Americans, as I understand it, because at the same time that Charles Dickens is writing A Christmas Carol, that's 1843, and he's exalting the praises of that huge turkey that Scrooge sends off to the Cratchits, Queen Victoria actually wanted chicken for Christmas dinner. How did that happen?
What happened was a British captain came back from China during the Opium Wars when England forced China to open its markets, and he gave to Queen Victoria seven beautiful chickens. Now, these were not your regular scrawny English chickens. These were large, fluffy, almost furry creatures that seemed impossibly exotic, and Queen Victoria was entranced. So she had an aviary built right there at Windsor Castle, and she and her husband, Albert, would go down and visit these chickens every day, and she loved them, and they became a sensation in England. So people started to copy this. Everybody wanted this exotic chicken. So as ships were coming from China more frequently, people started to buy these chickens at enormous prices, $10,000 for a single chicken. So the prices skyrocketed, and people all over England began to breed these Chinese chickens that were very large and had a lot more meat on them with the English chickens, which were a lot hardier. And by combining the genes of these of the East chicken and the West chicken, we created the modern chicken.
Well, in America, the chicken was also, around this same time, affecting some interesting economic changes. And I'd like for you to tell us about the relationship between the African-American slaves and the chicken.
What I discovered was that in West Africa, the chicken was extremely important 400 and 500 years ago. In fact, it was the chicken, as it entered West Africa, that made possible village life. Suddenly, people could come together, live in large numbers, produce chickens, which provided that necessary protein. And West Africans were very adept at raising chickens, which were also considered quite sacred. They formed an important part of many of their religious rituals. So when slaves were brought from West Africa to the United States, starting in the 1600s, The chicken was something that they were extremely familiar with. Now, by contrast, most of the Europeans didn't really think too much about chickens because they had other things. They had ducks, they had geese, and certainly in the New World, there was the turkey to compete. So chickens were kind of rather unimportant at first. So as a result, the slaves were allowed to keep chickens and raise chickens and even sell those chickens to their masters on plantations. And this turned into quite a business. Beginning in the early 1600s, all the way up into the Civil War, the African Americans were known in places like Virginia as the general chicken merchants, that not just slaves, but also freed blacks were able to travel around and sell chickens and eggs and actually make money. It was one of the only ways that African Americans, particularly in the East, were allowed to engage in the entrepreneurial spirit.
But in the North, it's Jewish women and chickens.
Yes. So in the late 1800s, New York and other cities were swamped with huge numbers of refugees and immigrants fleeing the pogroms in Eastern Europe. And the Jews that came in were big chicken eaters. And the reason is, of course, that pork was proscribed and that beef was very expensive. Before that, there was not much of a market for chicken, or certainly not for chicken meat. And here were millions of people demanding chicken. So as a result, people in the South and the Midwest began to respond to this demand. So you have this very interesting kind of collection of very different peoples. You have the African Americans in the South. You have rural women, white and black, both in the Midwest and the South, who are very, very poor, looking for a way to make a little extra pin money. And then you have the new railroads that were coming into being that could actually take the chickens from these rural areas to the industrializing North for the first time. And so this is what galvanized the modern chicken.
World War II comes along. Tell us how that rolled.
Well, in the beginning of World War II, the government had to make some tough choices, and beef and pork were consigned to the troops. So everybody else was left with chicken, which at the time was not an ideal food. It was kind of stringy, was something you might have for Sunday dinner. But again, it was not really considered the most tasty of meats. So in World War II, people suddenly didn't have a choice. They had to eat a lot of chicken. So the chicken industry began to spring up. There are lots of new incubation factories that sprang up. And suddenly you have lots of chickens being processed by the millions for the first time.
Really, it's just shocking to me that the chicken and the women have this beautiful symbiotic relationship. But all of a sudden, in the 1950s, after World War II, men take over the chicken world with their self-proclaimed chicken of tomorrow.
Yes, our great-grandmothers or great-great-grandmothers, they would keep chickens around and throw the scraps out the back door. And men, particularly men who were farmers, they looked down on chickens. They thought chickens were women's work. But you're right. By the end of World War II, the business had passed into the hands not of African Americans and not women, and certainly not the Jews, but instead it was in the hands of mainly white Southern men who decided that this was a business that could boom.
Well, Andrew, we've gone through industrial chicken farming, the horrors of that everybody's well aware of. But today, a lot of kids, I don't think they even know that the chicken is a bird necessarily, because all they know is chicken tenders, you know, whatever the heck the tender is. What do you think the future of the chicken is?
Well, it's not just the kids who don't know that the chicken is a bird. It's also the federal government. Because according to U.S. federal law, the chicken is not an animal if it's grown for food. This is a little shocking that even the pig and even a cow is considered to be an animal, and there are some very minimal standards applied for animal welfare in their case. But if you are growing a chicken for food, there is absolutely no standard that you must be held to. You can't be put in jail for anything you do to a chicken if it's being raised for chicken tenders. Now, that's not true if you're using it for research or even if a chicken is in a circus. There are certain rules that apply. But in this case, I find it quite amazing, given how much the chicken has given us over the millennia, that today we don't even give it the dignity of being an animal.
It's pretty shocking. These particular regulations, how far do they date back, or is it something that was just overlooked?
Well, it was not overlooked. It was the chicken industry not really wanting to be regulated, and they have the political power to prevent any regulations from being put in place. And most people don't know about it. And really, it's not just that the industry is trying to hide what they're doing, although they are. It's also that we, as Americans, are avoiding this whole question. We really would rather not know. And I'm guilty of this. I still eat chicken. I'll still buy that chicken taco, even though I know something more than I want to know about the conditions that most chickens actually live under.
Yeah, that's it's bad news. But luckily today, with farmers markets and with people really caring about the ethical care of animals, we're starting to see a little turnaround with that.
There is, although keep in mind that the chickens that you get, even at your farmer's market, probably are that same industrial chicken that was produced from a Chicken of Tomorrow contest in 1950.
Well, my goodness, Andrew. At this point, all I can say is thank God for the chicken. And thank you so much for coming to talk with us on Louisiana Eats.
Absolutely. It was great fun. Thank you.
Andrew Lawler, author of Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? Hey, chicken, you're out talk. When we come right back, we'll answer the eternal question, how do you roast a perfect chicken? Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blended beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How do you roast a perfect chicken? First, make sure you've got the right chicken. That would be one that weighs 4 pounds or less. Next, salt the chicken well inside and out and put it in a roasting pan. Preheat the oven to 400 degrees and place the chicken in the center of the oven. Your chicken will roast in about an hour, and you'll know it's done when you can poke it and the juices run clear. Your instant read thermometer should read 170 degrees when inserted into the thickest part of the thigh. Once the chicken's done, put it on the carving board and let it rest for at least 10 minutes before carving it. The resting allows the juices to settle properly and not all run out the minute you slice into the bird. I'm Poppy Tooker. And you're listening to Louisiana Eats. There are few people in this world who can say that bartending has taken them to all but one of the seven continents. Born in a tiny village in the Czech Republic, Zdeněk Kastanek began serving drinks at the tender age of 17. And 13 years later, his bartending prowess, creative genius in cocktail innovation, and pure ambition has taken him behind some of the most glamorous watering holes across the globe.
I was fortunate enough to study when I was 14 as an apprentice chef in one of the little three-star family-run hotel.
So first you were cooking?
Yes. Cooked in this hotel while I was still at school, obviously, and then kind of fell in love with it. And really, that was like kind of what I wanted to do. I was like, I'm going to be chef. And when I was 17, I was again, lucky enough, and I was asked by a young company, five guys in one of the big cities. They were opening bars and restaurants, and at that time I was doing competitions with International Bartending Association, IBA, And they saw me in one of those competitions and asked me to come over and help them to kind of not run the bars, because I didn't have any expertise in that, but help them to make it maybe a little bit better.
And then how did the wandering begin?
Well, I always wanted to wander around the world. It was kind of something what my mom keeps saying, that I kind of show signs of it since I was little. I'll be always doing something on my own somewhere. And when I finished my school, the first plan was that I'm going to go straight away. Because when I was between second last and my last year, I kind of packed my bag for summer holiday and went to London on a bus. It was 26 hours. At that time, I had no money for flying at the time. So I took a bus from Prague to London. As I found out very quickly, I wasn't the only one having that idea. And when I tried to get any jobs, the only couple of sentences I knew in English,
yes,
at that time, that said, "Hello, my name is Zdeněk Staněk. I'm from Czech Republic and I can't work here for 2 months because I have to go back to finish my school."
Good. So you got those two sentences.
That one.
What was the job you took with two sentences?
Well, I scored Subway job. That was the first one. But they
Subway sandwich?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my gosh.
But they told me that, look, if we're going to give you a training and everything, it's going to take some time. And by the time you finish the training, you have to go back because you have to finish your school. So it's kind of no point for us to give you a job because you have to leave anyway.
So how did you negotiate that?
Well, I didn't. I had no English. So I was like, okay, fair enough. There's nothing else I can't do then about it. So I spent 3 weeks trying, and then went back to Czech.
After getting his first taste of the big city, Zdeněk didn't wait long before leaving his village again. He hit the road to the cosmopolitan center of the Czech Republic, Prague, where he took up the dazzling art of flair tending, a form of entertainment bartending that involves performing mesmerizing tricks with bottles and shakers and other crowd pleasers.
You 17, 18, 19, single, lots of girls at the bars, and you know, if you can show off a little bit to score numbers, that's what you do.
Yeah, I bet.
So that was kind of thing which most of the young bartenders did at the time. And the biggest example is, like, you obviously seen Cocktail movie. And that bar was freestyle bar, so we had three synchronized shows. The hippie shake from the Cocktail was one of them.
Wow.
So I was doing that for a year, kind of build it up to actually being a bar manager of that bar. And when I kind of hit that, I was like, okay, I don't think that there's anything else what I can achieve.
I'm not going to spend my life in flair bartending.
Exactly.
From there, Zdeněk returned to classic bartending, to a world of white jackets, gloves, and some of the most upscale clientele. There, he met a living legend of the Czech bartending world, George Nemec, who would become his role model in the craft of cocktails. Little did he know that this mentorship would quickly transport him to bartending down under.
6 months later, we, with all our visa and all of the paperwork we needed, we landed in Sydney.
Wow.
It's always amazing when, like, you never think about it, right, on your own. So
right.
It's nice to when you actually say that, then you realize that, oh, I didn't have that bad life, actually.
No, you have had, and it's not half done.
It's not done, that's for sure. Oh, at least I hope it's not.
No, you
half
never
done.
Know, I know.
So yeah, Australia landed, and as I had no English, there was no really any job I could do which would involve talking to anyone.
I see.
So from bar manager from Prague, I went right down to the beginnings and was an ashtray polisher.
Ashtray polisher?
Yes. So I moved into bar baking in 2 weeks and went to school every day, Monday to Friday, to English school, 8 o'clock in the morning till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Had my lunch, had my little nap, and then straight to work, and then bar back from 5 till 2 a.m., sleep, 4 hours of sleep, back to school, like that for 3 months. But yeah, in 6 months, I scored a full, as a junior bartender, job.
With each job came a new learning opportunity for Zdeněk that soon elevated him to the upper echelon of cocktail bars in Sydney. Stenick was soon recognized for his vision and recruited to teach emerging bartending talent in Australia.
So now you're a trainer. So
yeah.
How many years has it been since you were an ashtray polisher?
This is 2 years. Up until today, I still don't know how the hell they kind of trusted me that I'm able to. I remember my first trainings, and half of the training I actually had to fully memorize. But as you do it over and over and over and over, you kind of learn and grew from there. And I was 23 at the time. And so it was time to leave again.
Now, worlds away from his humble beginnings, making Subway sandwiches in London, Zdenek returned to the UK and began vying for jobs in top hotels and exclusive members-only clubs.
Okay. I went over there and helped give it to my little check spin, I guess, to it.
What is the check spin exactly?
I don't know. I got asked many times. I have, you know, few bullet points of what I always do or the way how I live my life.
What are
a few
they?
Rules.
Tell me the bullet points.
I hugely believe that if you want to be a bartender or anyone who hosts people, you have to be, first of all, you have to be a good person. If you're trying to host anyone for any other reason than your passion, you're always going to fail. It's very hard to act like you really mean that,
yes,
you're hosting someone if you do it for money.
You need the sincerity.
Yeah, exactly. There's one book which kind of helped me to, in a funny way, to understand what it means to be a good person, and it's Robert Fulghum wrote, All I Need to Know I Learned in a Kindergarten. If you haven't read that one, read it. Don't lie, don't steal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you have all of those manners or you have all of those rules and your team can see that and follow that, then you surround yourself with same quality people, then anyone who walks into your bar or your restaurant or your hotel will feel that.
Stenick's humble Czech spin on true hospitality won him a flawless reputation among the celebrity patrons of the members-only bar scene in London. At the age of 25, Stenick was swept up by a man who Stenick calls the Prince of India, Ariad Boss, and recruited to be a road tour trainer. Without hesitation, Stenick picked up his life again and moved halfway across the world to train bartenders in the finest hotels across India.
It was definitely another great experience. We managed to train or managed to get 900 bartenders into our classes in 6 months.
Fantastic.
And while I was doing that, I got a phone call from Singapore, from this amazing bar called 28 Hong Kong Street. One of the partners there, Michael Callahan, who I met in New Zealand a couple of years before, he said, look, we have a plans to open this little distribution company. We want to bring it to the next level. I need your help. Are you interested? And as I was finishing that Skype, 9 hours later, I landed in Singapore.
This move to Singapore brings us to where Zdenek is today. He's the general manager of Proof & Company, an elite distribution business that's helping to shape the preeminent cocktail bars of Singapore.
Singapore's a very interesting one. Actually, the drinking scene and foodie scene is brilliant and very vibrant, very young, but kind of going a million miles an hour at the moment.
So, Zdenek, tell me, I go to 28 Hong Kong Street to your bar. Describe the experience you're going to give me there.
When 28 opened, I think that the whole idea was just to open what you would normally call neighborhoody bar in America, but doing it in a new market where no one really knows what the real good cocktail drinking scene is, or in any way what good bars are. So we kind of wanted to open this place without saying, here we are the best, or we are brand new and no one else is same as us, and you all have to come over here and be blown away.
Yeah.
We wanted to open it in a way like with another 20 great cocktail bars. And it's normal in Singapore to go and drink cocktails. Kind of like make the guests to feel that they're already educated. in that way. So the culture is always different. And if it's very money orientated, which that part of Asia is, then you can see it on your guests and the way how they just, you know, in a way, they really going against what I believe is to be a good person, which I always say to everyone, if you want to really know what this person is about, take them to a place which you know has a bad service. And you see how that person treats that bad service of that waiter.
How the person reacts.
If that person's rude and arrogant, then you know that you don't need to be around that person. But, you know, if that person is understanding and it's like, oh, it's okay, it happens to everyone, don't worry about that, I'm fine, I can wait for my dish in another 20 minutes, etc., then you know it's a good guy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the culture is always hugely different.
You describe yourself now as a spirits evangelist. What is that?
Okay. When the distribution company was in the plans, we created a whole part of the business which was all about education and basically how we're going to make sure that, you know, all our clients kind of love what we do and how we're going to help them to succeed with their businesses, which is actually the core point of our business. So we do from drawings of stainless steel work to recommending all of the machinery and brands and to creating cocktail lists to sourcing things like champagne yeast if you need them for whatever reason.
Yeah.
To actually distribute the alcohol for you. So you kind of get this whole package. Once you work with us, then we always there to help you. And the spirit evangelist is the actual person who is responsible for you as a client.
Must be very exciting to work every day.
It is, yes. It's definitely not waking up in the morning feeling bad that you have to go to work. It's like, okay, another day. What can we achieve today?
Zdenek Kastanek, spirits evangelist at Proof & Company in Singapore.
I am Oran Lerner. I'm from Tel Aviv. I'm the owner of the French 57 bar in Tel Aviv.
Circle the globe and you'll quickly learn that New Orleans has left its mark in some unexpected places. Oran Lerner has brought a bit of New Orleans to his hometown of Tel Aviv, Israel. Our food and festivals translate particularly well in Tel Aviv, which is the nightlife capital of Israel. Oran is also a former apprentice at Tales of the Cocktail, so we got to meet him during his last visit to the city. He told us all about his Tel Aviv bar, the French 57, a living tribute to the New Orleans cocktail.
How do you translate the New Orleans culture into the culture at the French 57 in Tel Aviv?
I think we've had an easier job in Tel Aviv than we would have had here, mostly because very few Israelis ever visit New Orleans. It's a very far destination to go to. But I was lucky enough to be here twice already for Tales of the Cocktail before we opened the French 57. I had some idea as to what is New Orleans food, New Orleans cocktails, drinks, music, vibes, and all. And we started working from there. We started doing our research. Are we 100% New Orleans? Probably not. But we're working very hard on bringing in a lot of it, mostly when it comes to the vibe. We're talking about a lot of sentences written both in our motto and on the bar itself. So, laissez le bon temps rouler, for example. Just let the good times roll. Let's have fun. Let's bring in live music. Let's do it approachable and easygoing, but let's give very high quality ingredients, very high quality product. There are a couple of Israelis living here very into restaurants, both at Shaya and Doris Metropolitan. We know the chefs, we know the owners. They love us. They visit us when they come in, and they give us a lot of points and reviews. We've been talking to Chris Hanna from the French 75 to try and get the right vibe, the right feel, and the right quality of drinks. We get a lot of people who were in New Orleans, either living or visiting in New Orleans, come in and give us great reviews. Tell us, look, guys, you guys are doing great.
Are you serving our kind of cocktails? What is at your bar that we might find familiar?
You'll get an amazing Sazerac. We have to import our own rye to make sure we make a decent Sazerac, but we do that. You'll get Ramon's Gin Fizzes, you'll get French 75s, you'll get amazing Bloody Marys. We use the Louisiana hot sauce, the local Tabasco. You'll get incredible. We have several versions for the Hurricane. The classic one's a little less palatable for Israelis. It's a little too strong for us.
The classic one can be a little less palatable for some of us, frankly, Oran. Yeah.
So we focus on cocktails. We have just one beer on draft. We don't serve wine. So you'll get a huge selection of cocktails, but a very limited selection of anything else. And when it comes to the cocktails, we also try to put in a lot of effort to make the end result be high quality.
Well, I'm very fascinated that not only do you serve New Orleans-style cocktails, but you're also serving our food?
That was a huge challenge, a huge challenge. We don't have an in-house chef. We work with several consulting chefs or supportive. One of the consulting chefs was actually working here, was apprenticing at Doris Metropolitan. Again, all our friends, so they come in of their own accord to help us out, build a sort of New Orleans-oriented menu. It's very challenging in many ways. The ingredients are often a lot more expensive. For example, oysters or seafood in general in Israel would be rather expensive.
Yes.
You couldn't get a dollar oyster as you can get here sometimes. It's incredible. We done a tribute to the Oyster Fest last month. We had four different kinds of oysters. We tried to sell them as cheap as we could. It didn't really work out. They weren't cheap. But we did Oyster Rockefeller, we did Oyster Bienville, we did fried oysters. We've got a po' boy menu, several different kinds, shrimp, bacon. We serve soft-shell crabs in a po' boy. We serve...
I'm amazed you can get soft-shell crabs in Israel.
You could. We serve crab cakes. We're very, very proud of our crab cakes, but they take a lot of work. And we try to come up with as many more things as we can. We have beignets on the menu. They're probably not as good as you can get them here. But then again, we try. We try to give in a sample of the culture.
That's great. Now, the music, you said you have live music. Is it jazz?
Yeah, mostly jazz and blues. The venue is very small. And as soon as you put in something electronic, the volume goes up and you kind of lose the atmosphere. But alive, now it's a jazz trio. We had a small brass band play about once or twice a month. We had them play every day during the Mardi Gras when we did that.
So you celebrate Mardi Gras over there,
We try to celebrate every festivity that happens in New Orleans. We try to bring it in. Next month, we'll do the blues and barbecue. We're still trying to figure out how we're going to do that or what we're going to serve. But everything that happens in New Orleans, we try to bring a little sample of it to Tel Aviv.
And so do you find the people in Tel Aviv are responding to this and very excited about this taste of New Orleans?
You know, we're talking about that as partners. Tel Avivists do not know what New Orleans mean. If you say it's a New Orleans bar, they'll just shrug and move on and say, I don't know what that means, but I'll come by and taste or try. The few who know what that is are very excited about it. The people who don't know, it could go either way. But then we're very distinct in that sense. You can walk in and decide, all right, this is either my kind of bar or not my kind of bar. We're okay with that.
Oran Lerner, owner of the French 57 Bar in Tel Aviv. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week for a lesson on table manners from the great, magnificent Chef Jeremiah Tower.
The whole point of the book is, it's not about you. If there are other people involved, especially somebody giving a party, I mean, if the host starts doing selfies, feel free.
Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. If you love Louisiana Eats, let others know and help like-minded Louisiana food lovers find our show by leaving a review on iTunes. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from Tableau, Dickie Brennan's latest restaurant, serving local Creole cuisine with a view of Jackson Square. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook as well. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.